For 2 days they rode, 2 days of watching sleet turn to rain, turn to purple sunsets, and one night knotted on the wooden seats, their heads on folded coats, trying not to hear the snoring soldiers. When they changed trains in Birmingham for the last leg of the trip, they discovered what luxury they had been in all through Kentucky and Tennessee, where the rest stops all had colored toilets. After Birmingham, there were none. Helene's face was drawn with the need to relieve herself, and so intense was her distress, she finally brought herself to speak about her problem to a black woman with 4 children who had got on in Tuscaloosa. "Is there somewhere we can go to use the restroom?" The woman looked up at her and seemed not to understand. "Ma'am?" Her eyes fastened on the thick velvet collar, the fair skin, the high-toned voice. "The restroom," Helene repeated. Then, in a whisper, "The toilet." The woman pointed out the window and said, "Yes, ma'am, yonder." Helene looked out of the window, halfway expecting to see a comfort station in the distance. Instead, she saw gray-green trees leaning over tangled grass. "Where?" "Yonder," the woman said. "Meridian. We be pulling in directly." Then she smiled sympathetically and asked, "Can you make it?" Helene nodded and went back to her seat, trying to think of other things, for the surest way to have an accident would be to remember her full bladder. At Meridian, the women got out with their children. While Helene looked about the tiny station house for a door that said colored women, the other woman stalked off to a field of high grass on the far side of the track. Some white men were leaning on the railing in front of the station house. It was not only their tongues curling around toothpicks that kept Helene from asking information of them. She looked around for the other woman, and seeing just the top of her head rag in the grass, slowly realized where yonder was. All of them, the fat woman and her 4 children, 3 boys and a girl, Helene and her daughter, squatted there in the 4 o'clock Meridian sun. They did it again in Ellisville, again in Hattiesburg, and by the time they reached Slidell, not too far from Lake Pontchartrain, Helene could not only fold leaves as well as the fat woman. She never felt a stir as she passed the muddy eyes of the men who stood like wrecked Dorics under the station roofs of those towns. The lift in spirit that such an accomplishment produced in her quickly disappeared when the train finally pulled into New Orleans. Cecile Sabat's house leaned between 2 others just like it on Elysian Fields, a Frenchified shotgun house. It sported a magnificent garden in the back and a tiny wrought iron fence in the front. On the door hung a black crepe wreath with purple ribbon. They were too late. Helene reached up to touch the ribbon, hesitated, and knocked. A man in a collarless shirt opened the door. Helene identified herself, and he said he was Henri Martin and that he was there for the setting up. They stepped into the house. The Virgin Mary clasped her hands in front of her neck 3 times in the front room and once in the bedroom where Cecile's body lay. The old woman had died without seeing or blessing her granddaughter. No one other than Mr. Martin seemed to be in the house, but a sweet odor as of gardenias told them that someone else had been. Blotting her lashes with a white handkerchief, Helene walked through the kitchen to the back bedroom where she had slept for 16 years. Nell trotted along behind, enchanted with the smell, the candles, and the strangeness. When Helene bent to loosen the ribbons of Nell's hat, a woman in a yellow dress came out of the garden and onto the back porch that opened into the bedroom. The two women looked at each other. There was no recognition in the eyes of either. Then Helene said, "This is your grandmother, Nell." Nell looked at her mother, and then quickly back at the door they had just come out of. "No, that was your great-grandmother. This is your grandmother, my mother." Before the child could think, her words were hanging in the gardenia air. "But she looks so young." The woman in the canary yellow dress laughed and said she was 48, an old 48. Then it was she who carried the gardenia smell, this tiny woman with the softness and glare of a canary. In that somber house that held four Virgin Marys, where death sighed in every corner and candles sputtered, the gardenia smell and canary yellow dress emphasized the funeral atmosphere surrounding them. The woman smiled, glanced in the mirror, and said, throwing her voice toward Helene, "That your only one?" "Yes," said Helene. "Pretty, a lot like you." "Yes, well, she's 10 now."
10? Vrai.
Small for her age, no?" Helene shrugged and looked at her daughter's questioning eyes. The woman in the yellow dress leaned forward. "Come, come, Cher." Helene interrupted. "We have to get cleaned up. We've been 3 days on the train with no chance to wash or..."
"Comment t'appelle?"
"She doesn't talk Creole."
"Then you ask her.
She wants to know your name, honey." With her head pressed into her mother's heavy brown dress, Nell told her and then asked, "What's yours?"
"Mine's Rochelle."
"Well, I must be going on." She moved closer to the mirror and stood there sweeping hair up from her neck back into its halo-like roll and wetting with spit the ringlets that fell over her ears. "I've been here, you know, most of the day. She passed on yesterday, the funeral tomorrow. Henri taking care." She struck a match, blew it out, and darkened her eyebrows with the burnt head. All the while, Helene and Nell watched her. The one in a rage at the folded leaves she had endured, the wooden benches she had slept on, all to miss seeing her grandmother and seeing instead that painted canary who never said a word of greeting or affection or... Rochelle continued, "I don't know what happened to the house. Long time paid for. You be thinking on it, we?" Her newly darkened eyebrows queried Helene. "We." Helene's voice was chilly. "I be thinking on it."
"Oh, well, not for me to say."
Suddenly she swept around and hugged Nell, a quick embrace, tighter and harder than one would have imagined her thin, soft arms capable of.
"Au revoir,"
and she was gone. In the kitchen, being soaped head to toe by her mother, Nell ventured an observation. "She smells so nice. And her skin was so soft." Helene rinsed the cloth. "Much handled things are always soft."
"What does voir mean?"
"I don't know," her mother said. "I don't talk Creole." She gazed at her daughter's wet buttocks. "And neither do you." When they got back to Medallion and into the quiet house, they saw the note exactly where they had left it and the ham dried out in the icebox. "Lord, I've never been so glad to see this place, but look at the dust. Get the rags now. Oh, never mind. Let's breathe a while first. Lord, I never thought I'd get back here safe and sound. Whew! Well, it's over. Good and over. Praise his name. Look at that. I told that old fool not to deliver any milk, and there's the can, curdled to beat all. What gets into people? I told him not to. Well, I got other things to worry about. Got to get a fire started. I left it ready so I wouldn't have to do nothing but light it. Lord, it's cold.
Don't just sit there, honey. You could be pulling your nose. Nell sat on the red velvet sofa, listening to her mother, but remembering the smell and the tight, tight hug of the woman in yellow who rubbed burned matches over her eyes. Late that night, after the fire was made, the cold supper eaten, the surface dust removed, Nell lay in bed thinking of her trip. She remembered clearly the urine running down and into her stockings until she learned how to squat properly, the disgust on the face of the dead woman, and the sound of the funeral drums. It had been an exhilarating trip, but a fearful one. She had been frightened of the soldier's eyes on the train, the black wreath on the door, the custard pudding she believed lurked under her mother's heavy dress, the feel of unknown streets and unknown people. But she had gone on a real trip, and now she was different. She got out of bed and lit the lamp to look in the mirror. There was her face, plain brown eyes, three braids, and the nose her mother hated. She looked for a long time, and suddenly a shiver ran through her. "I'm me," she whispered. "Me." Nell didn't know quite what she meant, but on the other hand, she knew exactly what she meant. "I'm me. I'm not their daughter. I'm not Nell. I'm me. Me." Each time she said the word me, there was a gathering in her, like power, like joy, like fear. Back in bed, with her discovery, she stared out the window at the dark leaves of the horse chestnut. "Me," she murmured. And then, sinking deeper into the quilts, I want to be wonderful. Oh, Jesus, make me wonderful. The many experiences of her trip crowded in on her. She slept. It was the last as well as the first time she was ever to leave Medallion. For days afterward, she imagined other trips she would take, alone though, to faraway places. Contemplating them was delicious. Leaving Medallion would be her goal. But that was before she met Zula, the girl she had seen for 5 years at Garfield Primary, but never played with, never knew, because her mother said that Zula's mother was Sooty. The trip, perhaps, or her newfound meanness, gave her the strength to cultivate a friend in spite of her mother. When Zula first visited the Wright house, Helene's curdled scorn turned to butter. Her daughter's friend seemed to have none of the mother's slackness. Nell, who regarded the oppressive neatness of her home with dread, felt comfortable in it with Zula, who loved it, and would sit on the red velvet sofa for 10 to 20 minutes at a time, still as dawn. As for Nell, she preferred Sula's woolly house, where a pot of something was always cooking on the stove, where the mother, Hannah, never scolded or gave directions, where all sorts of people dropped in, where newspapers were stacked in the hallway and dirty dishes left for hours at a time in the sink, and where a one-legged grandmother named Eva handed you goobers from deep inside her pockets or read you a dream. 1921. Zula Peace lived in a house of many rooms that had been built over a period of 5 years to the specifications of its owner, who kept on adding things. More stairways, there were 3 sets to the second floor, more rooms, doors, and stoops. There were rooms that had 3 doors, others that opened out on the porch only and were inaccessible from any other part of the house, others that you could get to only by going through somebody's bedroom. The creator,
and sovereign of this enormous house with the 4 sickle pear trees in the front yard and the single elm in the back was Eva Peace, who sat in a wagon on the 3rd floor directing the lives of her children, friends, strays, and a constant stream of boarders. Fewer than 9 people in the town remembered when Eva had 2 legs, and her oldest child, Hannah, was not one of them. Unless Eva herself introduced the subject, no one ever spoke of her disability. They pretended to ignore it, unless, in some mood of fancy, she began some fearful story about it, generally to entertain children. How the leg got up by itself one day and walked on off. How she hobbled after it, but it ran too fast. Or how she had a corn on her toe, and it just grew and grew and grew until her whole foot was a corn, and then it traveled on up her leg and wouldn't stop growing until she put a red rag at the top. But by that time, it was already at her knee. Somebody said Eva stuck it under a train and made them pay off. Another said she sold it to a hospital for $10,000, at which Mr. Reed opened his eyes and said, "Nigger gal, legs, going for $10,000 apiece?" As though he could understand $10,000 a pair, but for one? Whatever the fate of her lost leg, the remaining one was magnificent. It was stockinged and shod at all times and in all weather. Once in a while, she got a felt slipper for Christmas or her birthday, but they soon disappeared, for Eva always wore a black laced-up shoe that came well above her ankle. Nor did she wear overlong dresses to disguise the empty place on her left side. Her dresses were mid-calf, so that her one glamorous leg was always in view, as well as the long fall of space below her left thigh. One of her men friends had fashioned a kind of wheelchair for her, a rocking chair top fitted into a large child's wagon. In this contraption, she wheeled around the room from bedside to dresser to the balcony that opened out the north side of her room or to the window that looked out on the backyard. The wagon was so low that children who spoke to her standing up were eye level with her, and adults, standing or sitting, had to look down at her, but they didn't know it. They all had the impression that they were looking up at her, up into the open distances of her eyes, up into the soft black of her nostrils, and up at the crest of her chin. Eva had married a man named Boy Boy and had 3 children, Hannah, the eldest, and Eva, whom she named after herself, but called Pearl, and a son named Ralph, whom she called Plum. After 5 years of a sad and disgruntled marriage, Boy Boy took off. During the time they were together, he was very much preoccupied with other women and not home much. He did whatever he could that he liked, and he liked womanizing best, drinking second, and abusing Eva third. When he left in November, Eva had $1.65, 5 eggs, 3 beets, and no idea of what or how to feel. The children needed her, she needed money, and needed to get on with her life. But the demands of feeding her 3 children were so acute she had to postpone her anger for 2 years until she had both the time and the energy for it. She was confused and desperately hungry. There were very few black families in those low hills then. The Suggs, who lived 200 yards down the road, brought her a warm bowl of peas as soon as they found out and a plate of cold bread. She thanked them and asked if they had a little milk for the older ones. They said no, but Mrs. Jackson, they knew, had a cow still giving. Eva took a bucket over, and Mrs. Jackson told her to come back and fill it up in the morning because the evening milking had already been done. In this way, things went on until near December. People were very willing to help, but Eva felt she would soon run her welcome out. Winters were hard, and her neighbors were not that much better off. She would lie in bed with the baby boy, the two girls wrapped in quilts on the floor, thinking. The oldest child, Hannah, was 5 and too young to take care of the baby alone, and any housework Eva could find would keep her away from them from 5:30 or earlier in the morning until dark, way past 8. The white people in the valley weren't rich enough then to want maids. They were small farmers and tradesmen and wanted hard labor help, if anything. She thought also of returning to some of her people in Virginia, but to come home dragging 3 young ones would have to be a step 1 rung before death for Eva. She would have to scrounge around and beg through the winter until her baby was at least 9 months old. Then she could plant and maybe hire herself out to valley farms to weed or sow or feed stock until something steadier came along at harvest time. She thought she had probably been a fool to let Boy Boy haul her away from her people, but it had seemed so right at the time. He worked for a white carpenter and toolsmith who insisted on Boy Boy's accompanying him when he went west and set up in a squinty little town called Medallion. Boy Boy brought his new wife and built them a 1-room cabin 60 feet back from the road that wound up out of the valley, on up into the hills, and was named for the man he worked for. They lived there a year before they had an outhouse. Sometime before the middle of December, the baby, Plum, stopped having bowel movements. Eva massaged his stomach and gave him warm water. Something must be wrong with my milk, she thought. Mrs. Suggs gave her castor oil, but even that didn't work. He cried and fought so they couldn't get much down his throat anyway. He seemed in great pain, and his shrieks were pitched high in outrage and suffering. At one point, maddened by his own crying, he gagged, choked, and looked as though he was strangling to death. Eva rushed to him and kicked over the earthen slop jar, washing a small area of the floor with the child's urine. She managed to soothe him, but when he took up the cry again late that night, she resolved to end his misery once and for all. She wrapped him in blankets, ran her finger around the crevices and sides of the lard can, and stumbled to the outhouse with him. Deep in its darkness and freezing stench, she squatted down, turned the baby over on her knees, exposed his buttocks, and shoved the last bit of food she had in the world, besides 3 beets, up his ass. Softening the insertion with a dab of lard, she probed with her middle finger to loosen his bowels. Her fingernails snagged what felt like a pebble. She pulled it out, and others followed. Plum stopped crying as the black, hard stools ricocheted onto the frozen ground. And now that it was over, Eva squatted there, wondering why she had come all the way out there to free his stools. And what was she doing down on her haunches with her beloved baby boy, warmed by her body in the almost total darkness, her shins and teeth freezing, her nostrils assailed? She shook her head as though to juggle her brains around, then said aloud, "Uh-uh. No." Thereupon, she returned to the house and her bed. As the grateful Plum slept, the silence allowed her to think. 2 days later, she left all of her children with Mrs. Suggs, saying she would be back the next day. 18 months later, she swept down from a wagon with 2 crutches, a new black pocketbook, and 1 leg. First, she reclaimed her children. Next, she gave the surprised Mrs. Suggs a $10 bill. Later, she started building a house on Carpenter's Road, 60 feet from Boy Boy's 1-room cabin, which he rented out. When Plum was 3 years old, Boy Boy came back to town and paid her a visit. When Eva got the word that he was on his way, she made some lemonade. She had no idea what she would do or feel during that encounter. Would she cry, cut his throat, beg him to make love to her? She couldn't imagine. So she just waited to see. She stirred lemonade in a green pitcher and waited. Boy Boy danced up the steps and knocked on the door. "Come on in," she hollered. He opened the door and stood smiling, a picture of prosperity and goodwill. His shoes were a shiny orange, and he had on a citified straw hat, a light blue suit, and a cat's head stick pin in his tie. Eva smiled and told him to sit himself down. He smiled, too. "How you been, girl?" "Pretty fair, but you know good." When she heard those words come out of her own mouth, she knew that their conversation would start off polite, although it remained to be seen whether she would still run the ice pick through the cat's head pen. "Have some lemonade." "Don't mind if I do." He swept his hat off with a satisfied gesture. His nails were long and shiny. "Sure is hot, and I've been running around all day." Eva looked out of the screen door and saw a woman in a pea-green dress leaning on the smallest pear tree. Glancing back at him, she was reminded of Plum's face when he managed to get the meat out of a walnut all by himself. Eva smiled again and poured the lemonade. Their conversation was easy, she catching him up on all the gossip, he asking about this one and that one, and like everybody else, avoiding any reference to her leg. It was like talking to somebody's cousin who just stopped by to say howdy before getting on back to wherever he came from. Boy Boy didn't ask to see the children, and Eva didn't bring them into the conversation. After a while, he rose to go, talking about his appointments and exuding an odor of new money and idleness. He danced down the steps and strutted toward the pea-green dress. Eva watched. She looked at the back of his neck and the set of his shoulders. Underneath all of that shine, she saw defeat in the stalk of his neck and the curious tight way he held his shoulders. But still, she was not sure what she felt. Then he leaned forward and whispered into the ear of the woman in the green dress. She was still for a moment, and then threw back her head and laughed, a high-pitched, big-city laugh that reminded Eva of Chicago. It hit her like a sledgehammer, and it was then that she knew what to feel. A liquid trail of hate flooded her chest. Knowing that she would hate him long and well filled her with pleasant anticipation, like when you know you are going to fall in love with somebody and you wait for the happy signs. Hating Boy Boy, she could get on with it and have the safety, the thrill, the consistency of that hatred as long as she wanted or needed it to define and strengthen her or protect her from routine vulnerabilities. Once, when Hannah accused her of hating colored people, Eva said she only hated one, Hannah's father, Boy Boy, and it was hating him that kept her alive and happy. Happy or not, after Boy Boy's visit, she began her retreat to her bedroom, leaving the bottom of the house more and more to those who lived there, cousins who were passing through, stray folks, and the many, many newly married couples she let rooms to with housekeeping privileges. And after 1910, she didn't willingly set foot on the stairs but once, and that was to light a fire, the smoke of which was in her hair for years. Among the tenants in that big old house were the children Eva took in. Operating on a private scheme of preference and prejudice, She sent off the children she had seen from the balcony of her bedroom, or whose circumstances she had heard about from the gossipy old men who came to play checkers, or read the Courier, or write her number. In 1921, when her granddaughter, Sula, was 11, Eva had 3 such children. They came with woolen caps and names given to them by their mothers or grandmothers or somebody's best friend. Eva snatched the caps off their heads and ignored their names. She looked at the first child closely, his wrists, the shape of his head, and the temperament that showed in his eyes, and said, "Well, look at Dewey. My, 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 my." When later that same year she sent for a child who kept falling off the porch across the street, she said the same thing. Somebody said, "But Miss Eva, you calls the other one Dewey. So, this here's another one." When the third one was brought and Eva said Dewey again, everybody thought she had simply run out of names, or that her faculties had finally softened. "How is anybody going to tell them apart?" Hannah asked her. "What you need to tell them apart for? They's all Deweys." When Hannah asked the question, it didn't sound very bright, because each Dewey was markedly different from the other two. Dewey One was a deeply black boy with a beautiful head and the golden eyes of chronic jaundice. Dewey, too, was light-skinned with freckles everywhere and a head of tight red hair. Dewey, 3, was half-Mexican with chocolate skin and black bangs. Besides, they were 1 and 2 years apart in age. It was Eva saying things like, "Send one of them Deweys out to get me some Garrett. If they don't have Garrett, get Buttercup." Or, "Tell them Deweys to cut out that noise." Or, "Come here, you Dewey, you," and "Send me a Dewey," that gave Hannah's question its weight. Slowly, each boy came out of whatever cocoon he was in at the time his mother or somebody gave him away, and accepted Eva's view, becoming in fact, as well as in name, a Dewey, joining with the other two to become a trinity with a plural name, inseparable, loving nothing and no one but themselves. When the handle from the icebox fell off, all the Deweys got whipped, and in dry-eyed silence watched their own feet as they turned their behinds high up into the air for the stroke. When the golden-eyed Dewey was ready for school, he would not go without the others. He was 7, Freckle Dewey was 5, and Mexican Dewey was only 4. Eva solved the problem by having them all sent off together. Mr. Buckland Reed said, "But one of them's only 4. "How you know? They all come here the same year," Eva said. "But that one there was 1 year old when he came, and that was 3 years ago. You don't know how old he was when he come here, and neither do the teacher. Send him." The teacher was startled, but not unbelieving, for she had long ago given up trying to fathom the ways of the colored people in town. So when Mrs. Reed said that their names were Dewey King, and that they were cousins, and all were 6 years old, the teacher gave only a tiny sigh and wrote them in the record book for the first grade. She, too, thought she would have no problem distinguishing among them, because they looked nothing alike. But like everyone else before her, she gradually found that she could not tell one from the other. The Deweys would not allow it. They got all mixed up in her head, and finally she could not literally believe her eyes. They spoke with one voice, thought with one mind, and maintained an annoying privacy. Stout-hearted, surly, and wholly unpredictable, the Deweys remained a mystery, not only during all of their lives in Medallion, but after as well. The Deweys came in 1921, but the year before Eva had given a small room off the kitchen to Tar Baby, a beautiful, slight, quiet man who never spoke above a whisper. Most people said he was half white, but Eva said he was all white, that she knew blood when she saw it, and he didn't have none. When he first came to Medallion, the people called him Pretty Johnny, but Eva looked at his milky skin and corn silk hair, and out of a mixture of fun and meanness, called him Tar Baby. He was a mountain boy who stayed to himself, bothering no one, intent solely on drinking himself to death. At first, he worked in a poultry market, and after wringing the necks of chickens all day, he came home and drank until he slept. Later, he began to miss days at work and frequently did not have his rent money. When he lost his job altogether, he would go out in the morning, scrounge around for money doing odd jobs, bumming or whatever, and come home to drink. Because he was no bother, ate little, required nothing, and was a lover of cheap wine, no one found him a nuisance. Besides, he frequently went to Wednesday night prayer meetings and sang with the sweetest hill voice imaginable in the sweet by and by. He sent the Deweys out for his liquor and spent most of his time in a heap on the floor or sitting in a chair staring at the wall. Hannah worried about him a little, but only a very little, for it soon became clear that he simply wanted a place to die privately, but not quite alone. No one thought of suggesting to him that he pull himself together or see a doctor or anything. Even the women at prayer meeting, who cried when he sang in the sweet by and by, never tried to get him to participate in the church activities. They just listened to him sing, wept, and thought very graphically of their own imminent deaths. The people either accepted his own evaluation of his life or were indifferent to it. There was, however, a measure of contempt in their indifference, for they had little patience with people who took themselves that seriously enough to try to die. And it was natural that he, after all, became the first one to join Shadrach, Tar Baby, and the Deweys on National Suicide Day. Under Eva's distant eye, and prey to her idiosyncrasies, her own children grew up stealthily. Pearl married at 14 and moved to Flint, Michigan, from where she posted frail letters to her mother with $2 folded into the writing paper, sad little nonsense letters about minor troubles, her husband's job, and who the children favored. Hannah married a laughing man named Rikus, who died when their daughter Sula was about 3 years old, at which time Hannah moved back into her mother's big house, prepared to take care of it and her mother forever. With the exception of Boy Boy, those peace women loved all men. It was man-love that Eva bequeathed to her daughters. Probably, people said, because there were no men in the house, no men to run it. But actually, that was not true. The peace women simply loved maleness for its own sake. Eva, old as she was, and with one leg, had a regular flock of gentlemen callers. And although she did not participate in the act of love, there was a good deal of teasing and pecking and laughter. The men wanted to see her lovely calf, that neat shoe, and watch the focusing that sometimes swept down out of the distances in her eyes. They wanted to see the joy in her face as they settled down to play checkers, knowing that even when she beat them, and she almost always did, somehow, in her presence, it was they who had won something. They would read the newspaper aloud to her and make observations on its content, and Eva would listen, feeling no obligation to agree, and in fact would take them to task about their interpretation of events. But she argued with them with such an absence of bile, such a concentration of man-love, that they felt their convictions solidified by her disagreement. With other people's affairs, Eva was equally prejudiced about men. She fussed interminably with the brides of the newlywed couples for not getting their men's supper ready on time, about how to launder shirts, press them, and so forth. "Your man be here directly. Ain't about time you got busy." "Oh, Miss Eva, it'll be ready. We just having spaghetti." Again, Eva's eyebrows fluted up, and the newlywed pressed her lips together in shame. Hannah simply refused to live without the attentions of a man, and after Rikus's death had a steady sequence of lovers, mostly the husbands of her friends and neighbors. Her flirting was sweet, low, and guileless, without ever a pat of the hair, a rush to change clothes, or a quick application of paint, with no gesture whatsoever. She rippled with sex. In her same old print wraparound, barefoot in summer, in the winter her feet in a man's leather slippers, with the backs flattened under her heels, she made men aware of her behind, her slim ankles, the dew-smooth skin, and the incredible length of neck. Then the smile eyes, the turn of the head, all so welcoming, light, and playful. Her voice trailed, dipped, and bowed. She gave a chord to the simplest words. Nobody, but nobody, could say, "Hey, sugar," like Hannah. When he heard it, the man tipped his hat down a little over his eyes, hoisted his trousers, and thought about the hollow place at the base of her neck. And all this without the slightest confusion about work and responsibilities.